This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's jobs week, so how are you feeling about what you do? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, November 1st. Good to have you with us. It is a big week for watchers of the U.S. economy. There's the Fed meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday, when we should learn more about when the central bank will start scaling back its bond buying, effectively tapping the brakes on the economy and rising inflation. Then Friday, we'll get the latest jobs numbers for the month of October. Recent surveys show Americans are feeling pretty good about the job market these days, as the unemployment rate has fallen below 5%. But about the overall economy, sentiment is moving in the other direction. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looked into what's behind this unusual split.
People's feelings about the labor market and the greater economy usually run in tandem, two parallel lines on a graph. Laura Veldkamp is a professor of finance at Columbia Business School.
Business cycles tend to affect many parts of the economy in synchronization. This business cycle has been different.
Jobs outlook is about people's sense of what's happening right now. If I'm laid off today, can I get a job tomorrow? But when it comes to confidence in the economy,
it's a little bit more of an abstract question. And I think for many of us, it creates associations with what might be happening in the longer run.
If we've learned anything since March 2020, it's that it's hard to predict the future when it depends on a deadly virus. Ayelet Fishback researches consumer behavior at the University of Chicago.
Now, with this health crisis for the last couple of years, certainly there are other reasons to feel uncertain.
Will there be another variant? Will there be more lockdowns? And a much newer piece of uncertainty on everyone's minds?
The question is how much I can buy with the money that I make.
The I word, inflation. Maybe workers are getting a couple extra bucks an hour, but they're unsure of how far those extra bucks might go, or if wages will continue to match rising prices of goods and services. But people's feelings about their jobs and the outlook for the economy haven't broken up. They're just on a break. Adam Hirsch at the Economic Policy Institute says those two sentiments are intertwined.
If a lot of people are souring on the economy, they stop spending, they stop buying houses and starting businesses.
And stop fueling jobs. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Speaking of sentiment, it was pretty good on Wall Street today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The moment many parents have been waiting for is getting closer. COVID-19 vaccines for 5 to 11-year-olds could be available as early as this week. The CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee meets tomorrow to consider recommending the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for that age group. The decision comes as Johns Hopkins University reports a grim milestone in the pandemic. More than 5 million people around the world have died from COVID-19. Even as the fight against COVID continues, public health experts are already thinking about how to prepare for and respond to future pandemics. Dr. Sandro Galea is an epidemiologist and dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. He's written a new book called The Contagion Next Time. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
A lot of people might hear your title, The Contagion Next Time, and think, wait a minute, we're still dealing with the one in front of us. Why do you think it's time to talk about the next time?
Well, I think the pandemic has really been a tragedy. And there's nothing that redeems a tragedy, but certainly it would be even more of a tragedy if we do not learn from it. Yes, we're not through the pandemic right now, but I don't think it's too early to start thinking about the next one, because there are a lot of things that are fresh in our minds and becoming clearer about what happened.
And you make the argument in the book that a big part of this is not just the investment in vaccines and medicines and biotech, but in what you call the foundational drivers of health. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, what I mean by that is that obviously this was a pandemic that was caused by a virus, and the vaccines help us mitigate the virus. But the consequences of the virus played out the way they did because of our economic structures and the way our society was structured. So just to take one example, the people who were at greatest risk of exposure to this unknown virus were those who were in jobs where they could not work from home. They could not protect themselves. When we think about the next contagion, we should be thinking about how to fix these underlying structures, not when a pandemic hits us, but before. And that should start now.
It's interesting that you are an epidemiologist, but in many ways you're making an argument that the economy is really the big driver.
I suppose by disciplinary stripe, I'm a social epidemiologist. And social epidemiology is a field that emerged in the past 25 years that really is concerned with how social economic structures, things like wages, things like racism, things like how we build our cities and how all of that becomes health. Now, this is a relatively new area in epidemiology, but if one thinks about it, it actually goes back to the very roots of epidemiology. I mean, the very roots of public health come from mid-19th century industrialized countries that were cleaning up cities to reduce disease. And all of that was foundational to epidemiology and to public health. So in many respects, I'm urging us to think about our foundations and to say we should create a world where our foundations do not leave us exposed to the ravages of a virus like this one.
It strikes me that it's a little bit like the debate about expanding the definition of infrastructure to include social supports like childcare. Do you think we need to rethink what we think of as healthcare in our society?
I do. And I think we our words matter quite a bit. And you're right about the rethinking of the term infrastructure. When we think of health, we tend to think of medicine. And by medicine, we tend to think of pills or surgery. Well, if I were to tell you that your education matters more for your health than does any pill doctor is going to give you, well, maybe we should be thinking about education in the same breath as we think of medicine if we care about our health. And I was intrigued that you asked me this question and you used the term healthcare in your framing, because actually, I don't think you meant healthcare. I think you meant health. And the reason I'm actually pointing that out is simply to say that we often mistake the two. And the problem with mistaking the two is that we think that all of health is about healthcare and medicine, but actually it's not. Most of health is about where we live, where we work, where we play. And once we turn our brain to that, we move away then from spending all our resources only on medicine and to spending more resources on what's going to keep us healthy to begin with.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the role that housing plays in these foundational forces. Housing has been a huge issue during the pandemic, and it was the concern about the spread of the virus that led the CDC to impose a moratorium on evictions. How do you think this will change how we think about the role of housing in health?
Yeah, the housing example in the context of the pandemic is, I think, a perfect illustration of how underlying structures determine how we live through pandemics like this. People who were in crowded houses were at much greater risk of passing the virus amongst themselves, within the families, or the people they were living with. That's number one. Number two, housing provides shelter, particularly at a time of economic downturn. And if now we have people who are unemployed because of the shutdown and because their jobs no longer exist, who are now also homeless, that is going to introduce a full other range of health problems. So housing was a good example of how our health is all interconnected and inextricable from the conditions in which we live.
Dr. Sandro Galea, author of The Contagion Next Time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Wow. One industry that's been struggling to find enough workers is construction. And there's news from the Census Bureau today that spending by that industry fell in September, thanks to labor and materials shortages. That doesn't bode especially well for the housing crunch we've heard a lot about. But non-residential construction of office buildings, hotels, and transportation projects was down 6% from a year ago. Marketplace's Amanda Peacher has more.
The pandemic has shown us that there are some buildings we don't need more of right now, says Anibhan Basu, chief economist for Associated Builders and Contractors.
So the office segment has been pummeled by remote work, the hotel segment by the lack of recovery in business travel, and the retail space segment by the fact that we're doing more online shopping.
But there is one kind of commercial construction that's booming: warehouses. Ken Simonson is chief economist with Associated General Contractors of America.
The warehouses are just bulging with goods.
Goods from online orders or en route to big box stores. Retailers are trying to get ahead of supply chain slowdowns and stuffing warehouses ahead of the holidays.
So there's a huge need to build more warehouse capacity.
But even there, the challenge is still finding workers. The construction industry has some of the highest rates of vaccine hesitancy nationwide. That's a problem for new construction at hospitals or on government sites that have COVID-19 vaccine mandates. Steve Levy of McCown Gordon Construction says his company has a lot of openings right now for jobs in the field.
It's becoming harder and harder to find individuals that are vaccinated.
And then there are wages, which are on the rise in other sectors like hospitality. Levy says construction pay has typically been the thing that attracts workers.
Now everybody else is starting to catch up.
He says it's hard to convince people to work in the sun or out in the cold on construction sites when these days they could earn just as much indoors at a restaurant or in a hotel. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Previously, we kind of had an open door policy.
Yeah, the pandemic changed that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 94 points, 0.2% to finish at 35,913. The NASDAQ found 97 points, 0.6% to end at 15,595. And the S&P 500 ticked up 8 points, 0.1% to land at 4613. Record highs all around, I should say. We heard from Christian Schwab today that people's confidence in the job market is at its highest in some time. Looking at some HR-related stocks, HireQuest rose 2.7%. ADP, a payroll company, lost 1%. Workday, they make software, dropped 0.6%. American Airlines canceled more than 1,900 flights over the weekend due to bad weather. Canceled even more today. Still, American lifted 2.9% today. United was up 4.1%. JetBlue flew up 4.2%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.55%. You're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate minority leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Today is day two of the UN Climate Change Conference, COP26, in Glasgow, Scotland. Some of the world leaders there were also at the G20 summit in Rome over the weekend, and some climate and trade news came out of that meeting. The U.S. agreed to roll back tariffs former President Donald Trump had imposed on steel and aluminum imported from the European Union, and the EU agreed to lift retaliatory tariffs on some American imports, including bourbon whiskey and Harley-Davidson motorcycles that were set to double later this year. The U.S. and EU also agreed to work together over the next couple of years to limit imports of so-called dirty steel from countries like China, where steel production is creating a whole lot of carbon dioxide and contributing to climate change. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Making steel from iron spews a whole lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. In the traditional method, a furnace is heated to 4,000 or 5,000 degrees.
Just the act of doing that requires a tremendous amount of power.
Jennifer Hillman at the Council on Foreign Relations says the cheapest way to generate all that power is by burning coal.
Steel also requires, at the beginning, taking carbon and intensifying it, and then heating that up and then blasting oxygen into it. That is also a very carbon-intensive product.
Steel manufacturers in the U.S. and EU are working on decarbonizing that whole process, in part by using cleaner-burning fuels like hydrogen or natural gas. But that's hard and expensive, which is why Kevin Dempsey with the American Iron and Steel Institute says the industry is hoping this agreement between the U.S. and EU will eventually lead to some kind of border tax on dirty steel.
If we don't account for that at the border, it's going to be cheaper for people to import the dirtier but cheaper steel from China.
The thing is, steel from China isn't just cheaper because it's mostly made using coal. It's also cheaper because the Chinese government subsidizes steel production, and Chinese companies often export and sell a lot of steel at a loss. So the U.S. and EU joining forces to move toward restricting imports of carbon-intensive steel is also part of the trade war.
I think for Biden, it is much more about pushing back on China, because that's been one of the themes of his administration.
Bill Reinch is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Although in fairness, climate mitigation has been one of his themes, too.
And this, he says, is one convenient place where the two priorities come together. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
So back to jobs and businesses for our next couple of stories. We talked earlier about the labor market in the United States, where workers are feeling more confident and millions of jobs are open across the economy. In the United Kingdom, employers added more than 200,000 workers to payrolls in September, the biggest monthly increase in 7 years. Businesses there are relying on recruiting agencies and staffing companies to fill job postings. And in the English town of Stratford-upon-Avon, birthplace of Shakespeare, local officials are turning to an old tradition. The BBC's Elizabeth Hodson reports.
People can win on this one, that's right.
Every October, the charming English town of Stratford-upon-Avon holds an ordinary carnival with an unusual name. The mock fair looks like any other town fair, with rides, food stalls, and the chance to play games and win prizes. But this year, there's a new attraction, a job fair to help local businesses who are struggling to recruit enough staff. Matt Jennings from the local council says that this is actually a return to how the mock fair used to be.
The MOP originated back in the 1540s for local landowners to come and recruit their workers on the farms. And then they would have 2 days celebrating at the MOP fair afterwards.
So traditionally, the career fair came first, then workers threw a party to celebrate their new jobs. But that still doesn't explain the name.
It's called a MOP because originally in the lapels of your jacket, if you cut hay, you would have a bit of straw. If you did sheep, you would have a bit of wool. And that was called a mop. There were also the ladies who would work on the manors, and they would actually have mops and brooms. And that's what they would carry in.
At the modern mop held in the Stratford Playhouse, lapels are empty, but there are plenty of job seekers armed with their resumes. The day before the mop, Nicola Norman learned that she was at risk of being laid off. She heard about the mop fair on the radio and decided to head over.
We've just got to a point where things are a bit difficult in this area, so I'm here to look for something new and exciting.
And that's good news, because many companies here say that post-lockdown, customers have come back in their droves. But recruiting new staff has never been harder. Dave Williams is from a local bus and coach company.
Yeah, everything's back to better than what we thought. Like, we're back at 2019 levels. People want coaches all day long. And it's just finding the right people to drive those vehicles and promote our company.
Many of the employees at the MOP say no experience is required. They'll train you on the job. Like Kristen Bingle, who works for a tech training company called QA. She says events like this are a great way to encourage new applicants and challenge the stereotype that doing an apprenticeship in the field of technology is an option only for young people.
We've had a lot of older people come along today, people who are looking to reskill and retrain and looking to just to do something different. No age is a barrier to an apprenticeship, for sure.
So is this 2021 MOP Fair a one-off? Matt Jennings, the organiser from the local council, doesn't think so.
This is the first time we've put it on for 550 years. I'm very pleased with the amount of people who are here. We've had a lot of support. We're hoping to do it again next year. There's a tradition of MOPs. They move around Warwickshire. Our aim is to replicate that next year.
Although this tradition has been dormant for hundreds of years, now it seems the MOP is back for good. I'm the BBC's Elizabeth Hodson reporting for Marketplace.
What a journalist would wear in their lapel. Anyway, keeping a small business up and running during a pandemic is hard enough. Actually, thriving takes not just business savvy, but creativity. So for this installment of our series, My Economy, a peek inside an artist's mind.
My name is Jenny Tang, and I own and operate The Workshop Minneapolis, which is a ceramic studio in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Pre-pandemic, we were really focused on classes, and when we closed in March of 2020, we went from 75 to basically 3 people being in the studio regularly. It's funny, I can still get choked up thinking about it. It was devastating. I sat in the studio looking around at the space that I had created, and I just kept thinking, like, there must be some way for us to engage those students that we now can't have physically in our space. And so we ended up coming up with take-home kits that would have tools, materials. We also were able to rent out and sell equipment as well. And then we expanded a service that we had offered previously, which was kiln services. So we firework for other artists so that they were still working with clay. And that was even more important when folks were at home. We reopened in September 2020. And one of the things that we did was we switched to an appointment-based reservation system for our studio space. So previously, we kind of had an open door policy. When we reopened, we needed that security. And much like you would make an appointment to get your hair cut, you do the same thing, except you do that with pottery wheels or with a hand building table. The thing that we've noticed post-pandemic is we have a lot more folks who are taking one session of classes, and then they transition into what we call an open studio membership, which is working around the studio self-directed, and they then rent the studio space on an hourly basis. And that has seen a dramatic increase. For instance, in October, we had 33 new students. So we've diversified the ways in which people engaged with the space. I had no idea that over a year later, we would be in this place where we are successful and we're doing it in a way that feels really true to what our goal here is, to sort of expand creativity with people. So I feel very, very, very fortunate that we seem to be doing really, really well. And I'm really happy about that.
That was Jenny Tang, keeping things going at the Workshop Minneapolis. We mean it when we say we can't do this series without you. Let us know how your economy is doing at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out, October was the best month for movies, at least in North American theaters, since the start of the pandemic. The roughly $638 million in ticket sales for the month, according to Comscore, beat the previous record set in July. Most of that was from big studio releases like the latest Bond movie, No Time to Die, Halloween Kills, and, of course, Dune, which brought in $15.5 million in its second weekend. Much debate has been had on how much better those numbers might have been had Warner Brothers not simultaneously released the film on HBO Max. Reports say that strategy, which folks at home may have loved, but many filmmakers and actors did not, will come to an end this year. Okay, we've got to go, but first, here's your moment of economic context for this Monday. We'll get an update tomorrow on the rate of home ownership in this country from the Census Bureau. Home ownership has been falling the past few quarters from a post-housing crash high of nearly 68% in the second quarter of 2020 to just over 65% in Q2 of this year. That's overall. Home ownership among Hispanic and Latino and Black and African American households is about 25 to 30 percentage points lower than among white households. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. What a team, I'm telling you. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.